taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. If I sound a little different, well, I apologize for that. I am recording this in a hotel room between sessions of my Knowing Your Rights tour. I am sitting in Grand Forks, North Dakota. I wanted to take some time and record a message for you. Today, I want to talk a bit about, well, judges. Specifically, this idea of activist judges. Now, a lot of this springs from the brouhaha, the general upset I've heard from people about Joe Biden extending his eviction moratorium, the CDC's eviction moratorium, even though the Supreme Court has found it unconstitutional. Well, let's back up and let's deal with some facts here. First of all, the Supreme Court did not find the CDC eviction moratorium unconstitutional. It said they didn't have statutory power. The law that created the CDC did not grant them the power to issue an eviction moratorium. So that's different. In fact, the court even went so far to say, hey, if Congress were to pass such an eviction moratorium, then all set, go ahead. The problem isn't that the eviction moratorium is unconstitutional, is that the CDC doesn't have the legal authority to do it. But that brought me around to another interesting question that's actually going to take me all the way back to the 1800s. In fact, it's going to take me to 1800 itself. Now, how many of you have heard about the Supreme Court case Marbury versus Madison? Some of you might, because most lawyers and judges I've heard mention that Marbury versus Madison is where the Supreme Court gave to itself the power of judicial review. Now, being someone who likes to go back to the facts, I actually went back and read the opinion, which I found very interesting. And you'll find out it is applicable to this question of the CDC mandate and the Supreme Court. Now, this case, if you're not familiar, when John Adams lost to Thomas Jefferson in the 1800 presidential election, Adams tried to pack the courts. Not the Supreme Court, but the lower courts. He appointed judges and justices of the peace, and just as fast as he could crank these out, he was appointing them, and they had been approved by Congress, or by the Senate specifically. But there's another step. It's the actual signing of the commission of office. It's the president that actually does the appointment with the advice and consent of the Senate. So Adams had gotten the advice and consent of the Senate, but he didn't actually complete the appointment before he left office. So the new Secretary of State comes in, a gentleman by the name of James Madison, sees all of these judicial commissions waiting for his signature. He decided not to. So the questions before the court were, did Mr. Marbury, who was one of these, to receive one of these commissions, as well as the others in the suit, did they have the right to receive the commissions that had been approved by the Senate? Could these plaintiffs sue to get their commissions? And did the Supreme Court even have the authority to order the delivery of the commissions? So let's start with the question of judicial review. Chief Justice Marshall, when he wrote the opinion, did say it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. Okay, but that's not the end there. He goes on to say, those who apply the rule to particular cases must, of necessity, expound and interpret that rule. If two laws conflict with each other, the courts must decide on the operation of each. So when he's talking about judicial review, he's not talking about the way it's used today, where the courts basically overturn an act of Congress or an act of the president. He's talking about, listen, when a case comes before us, we need to look at the laws, we need to review them, we need to interpret and understand them, and then determine how to apply them. And if we have two laws that are in conflict, we must then deal with those problems. Now, the court went on to decide that, yes, these were legally made commissions, and that the plaintiffs did have the right to sue for them. But then they ran into a problem. See, legally what was being asked for is called a writ of mandamus. They wanted the court to order the executive branch to sign and issue these commissions, to which the court said, we don't have the authority to order the other branches to do anything. To enable this court to issue a mandamus, it must be shown to be an exercise of appellate jurisdiction or to be necessary to enable them to exercise appellate jurisdiction. But he said the law that enabled the court to issue these writs of mandamus, if it be applied to the executive branch, would violate the Constitution. It violates the separation of powers. So when people are apoplectic because President Biden dared defy the Supreme Court, it's one of the few things he's done I don't really have a problem with. The court doesn't have the legal authority to order. The court doesn't rule. The court isn't the final arbiter of what is. The states are. The states created the federal government. It's their creation. They oversee it. So I'm not as apoplectic that Biden is defying the court. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that Biden is defying the Constitution, that he's ignoring the Fifth Amendment and imposing, depriving people of their property without due process of law, and that none of the three branches of the federal government seem to recognize this. Everyone's talking about, well, you know, who's going to be hurt and you know, what's going to happen here, but no one's mentioning the fact that, wait a second, you're depriving people of their property without due process of law. Even the court, as I said, the Supreme Court, in their opinion, did not say that the eviction moratorium was unconstitutional. It merely said that the charter for the CDC, the commission, the law that created it, did not grant it the power to issue eviction moratoria. So everyone's kicking around these issues and ignoring the crux of the matter. The fact that the United States, regardless of how it is done, whether it's the judicial branch, the legislative branch, the executive branch, they are defying their oaths to the Constitution. They are exercising a power not delegated to it by the Constitution. They are depriving people of their property without due process of law in violation of the Constitution, and nobody is talking about it. At least not that I've heard. At least not, you know, there are a few fringe groups, fringe people that are talking about it. But for the most part, no one's arguing the fact that this truly is unconstitutional. And it seems like the only people that are bringing up the Constitution are falsely telling you that the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional when that's not what they said. So it is kind of a twisted mess. But that's part of why I'm here, is I'm here to kind of help untwist things. Next, let's take a look at some more judicial activism. Now, we now have a second federal court, this one from the Northern District of Texas, that has issued an injunction to prevent the President Biden's mandate that healthcare officials perform abortions and gender transition procedures. Now, again, you listen to me for any length of time, President Biden doesn't have the authority to mandate that that any healthcare worker perform any sort of procedure. That's a deprivation of liberty without due process of law. Now, whether you think abortion is a good thing or a bad thing, or gender transition is a good thing or a bad thing, the very basic concept of liberty is you are free to live your life without external interference, except as is absolutely necessary for the safety and security of society. And I'm sorry, these are elective procedures, so they can't be necessary for the safety or security of society. But we come back to this original question. President Biden's order is void. He doesn't have the legal authority to order people to do that. It's a violation of the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton and the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison said, you can't do that. You know, you can't order to some, you know, any act contrary to the Constitution, repugnant to the Constitution, is void. So President Biden's orders, mandates, they're void. They're meaningless. But does that mean that a court has the authority to place an injunction to order the president to not enforce this particular mandate? Well, just as with Marbury versus Madison, the court, the judicial branch, doesn't have the authority to order the executive branch to do anything. If the Supreme Court couldn't order James Madison or the administration of President Jefferson to sign judicial commissions, how can a court order the president to not enact one of his orders? Now, they can point out that, listen, this is unconstitutional, this is a violation of your oath of office, but the court has no power to enforce such a mandate. Only the fact that the administration looks at this and says, okay, we're not, you know, we see your point, we're not going to push it, we will abide by your injunction, even though you have no way to actually stop us, we're going to abide by it. Now, what I found interesting is in the report I found on the Daily Caller, it says, quote, the ruling permanently enjoins Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra from interpreting or enforcing the law in a manner that would require them to perform or provide insurance coverage for gender transition procedures or abortions, included by denying federal financial assistance because of their failure to perform or provide insurance coverage for such procedures, or by otherwise pursuing, charging, or assessing any penalties, fines, assessments, investigations, or other enforcement actions. So it always grates on me when these reporters say, the court ruled. Right? This is not a ruling. This is actually issuing an injunction. This is the court saying, listen, we think that if you proceed, you will do serious harm to one part or the other, so don't do it. Don't do it until we get a chance to figure this out and deal with it. And what they're saying is, listen, you can't enforce the law. You cannot withhold federal financial assistance because of what they're doing. You can't assign them fines or penalties or even investigate them, any enforcement action. You cannot. But again, Xavier Becerra is an extension of President Biden. It's the executive branch, and all executive power is vested in the president. So, again, there's actually nothing physically stopping the president or Secretary Becerra from doing this. The courts have no power. As Alexander Hamilton said, they have neither force nor will, only judgment. So, for everyone that's like, oh, yay, yay, you know, another court has stopped them. Another court has said this is wrong. Another court has said you shouldn't be doing this. But we still have a president that they can go ahead and do it. They can still assess the fines. They can still do the investigations. There's nothing the court can actually do to stop them because they have neither force nor will, only judgment. And I'm still waiting to see what this court comes up with, the actual final judgment. That has yet to come. This is merely an injunction. You have to wait while this case proceeds through the court. So while we're talking about judges reacting to presidential edicts, I have two cases that involve states and how they are that are trying to stop the use of the illegal, unconstitutional federal unemployment benefit, the $300 a week bonus that the federal government has used, and that has done so much damage. I mean, first of all, the Constitution does not grant to the United States the power to do anything with unemployment. It does not allow Congress to collect taxes to pay for unemployment. This is a completely illegal program This is embezzlement. This is bribery. And people aren't talking about it. But several states have looked and said, you know what? There's a problem here. And that is, if you pay people not to work, strangely enough, they tend not to work. Now, several states have turned around and said, listen, we're going to end the $300 incentive to not work that's coming from the federal government. So I have two states, Ohio and Oklahoma, both of which have stopped the supplemental funding of unemployment, both of which have been sued in federal court to get them to continue the $300 additional benefit from the federal government. And let's take a look at these. See, a judge in Franklin County, Ohio, again, it's reported that ruled, right? They opined that they can't do it. Quoting, it says, the court is aware of and sympathetic to the thousands of Ohioans without work and in desperate need of any assistance available, but the court simply cannot legislate from the bench and overlook the clear terms of Ohio law. In other words, what Ohio did was legal. In fact, I would go so far as it would say it was the right thing to do, not because of it, you know, it would cut benefits to unemployed Ohioans, not because of any sense of fair play. It's a simple question of this money was ill-gotten gains. The state of Ohio, the federal government didn't have the authority to collect federal taxes to give the state of Ohio money to pay these unemployment benefits. Now, I don't think that's why Governor DeWine stopped issuing these benefits, but the simple fact is there's no legal authority for the federal government to do this. However, this court in Ohio said, listen, we looked at the law and we can't change the law. We're the court, not the legislature. We can't change the law. We can't simply overrule what the legislature and the governor have done simply because some people don't like it. That's not their job. Now compare that with a judge in Oklahoma who's issued a preliminary injunction blocking the state from ending the $300 a week supplement from the federal government. Now, I find this one interesting because the judge wrote a letter to the attorneys in the case stating, quote, Oklahoma shall notify the U.S. Department of Labor immediately to reinstate and administer the federal unemployment benefit programs. Well, if we have separation of powers, I'm not familiar with the Constitution of Oklahoma, but does this judge have the legal authority to order the executive branch, to order the state of Oklahoma to continue to implement this, to notify the federal government that we will continue to participate in this? That'd be something interesting for someone in Oklahoma that knows more about the Oklahoma Constitution. Does the Constitution grant to the state government the authority, the state judiciary, the authority to order the state to do something? Because if that's true, well, then they've got a bigger problem, because then Oklahoma no longer has a Republican form of government. A Republican form of government, which is guaranteed, the federal government, the United States, is to guarantee to each state a Republican form of government, means that the people elect representatives to exercise their power. Now, I don't know if this judge is elected or not, but the job is not of a judge is not to exercise the power, is to offer an opinion in a case. See, this is where I get so infuriated when people focus on the ends and ignore the means and never ask, hey, wait a second, is this legal? Is this constitutional? You know, maybe you live in Oklahoma and you're happy to get your extra $300 a month, so you're all excited, or you think the people should be getting the extra $300 a month and you're excited, and you completely ignore the question of, does this judge actually have this authority, or is this judge just committed a crime, a usurpation of power, a violation of their oath of office, a violation of the Constitution of Oklahoma? These are all questions that I don't think most people are asking. We spend so much time fighting over the bits and pieces, we ignore the fundamental question of, does the federal government have the authority to spend this money? Does a judge have the authority to to order another branch of the government around. Does the state have the authority to accept this money? We never ask this question, and that truly concerns me. It concerns me that we've become so divorced from the Constitution and a Republican model of government that we don't even consider these things anymore. We don't stop to think about, is this a power justly exercised? And I think that's a lot of the reason why we see such an out-of-control federal government, because we don't even know the limits of what the federal government legally can and cannot do. And that leaves us in a place where we end up in a very kind of a sticky wicket, you know. Is it we're going to enforce the Constitution when the ends are an end we are happy with, but not when it's an end that we're not happy with? Do we truly believe that the ends justify the means, and I can legitimately do whatever I want as long as it's for a good reason? You know, I was having a Q&A with some college students a couple months ago, and that was pretty much the suggestion that was made by one student. We were talking about the rights that are being violated, and the student said, you know, well, you know, if we're violating the rights for the right reason, you know, society hasn't come to an end. And I had to point out that, you know, being older, I've had a lot more experience than this person had, and I then went through a list of the liberties, the freedoms, the rights that had disappeared just in my lifetime because we considered that maybe the ends justify the means. Now, again, whether you think an extra $300 a week for unemployment is a good thing or not, the question is, does government exercise power, just powers, only by the consent of the governed? If we did not consent in the Constitution to the federal government spending this money, collecting taxes to spend for this purpose, then that is an unjust power, which means we're dealing with an unjust government. And we will have to live with this unjust government until we, the people, realize that we actually have the power to tell the federal government no, and we're going to stop doing it. Which brings me all the way back to President Biden basically telling the Supreme Court, thank you for your opinion, but I'm going to go ahead and do this anyway. It really comes down to the states to say, all right, wait a second, yes or no. The ultimate check on the federal government is not the Supreme Court. It's the states and the people. And whether or not the states will stand up to their creation and say, we did not delegate to you that power, you do not have that power, that is an unjust power, and we will not comply. And if enough states decide they will not comply, well, pretty much we can then turn it into, well, we will nullify your action because a majority of the states that created you said what you're doing is wrong. But since most politicians and state governments wouldn't know the Constitution if it bit them in the backside, I'm not holding my breath for anything like that to happen. But this is why I encourage us all to read and study the Constitution, to know our rights, that we can defend them for ourselves. Because if we're expecting governments to defend our rights, well, we're expecting what hasn't been historically a process. The governments, the federal government isn't defending our rights. The state governments aren't defending our rights. In many cases, your local and county governments may not be defending your rights. So we really need to learn to do it for ourselves. And the interesting thing is, if we understand our rights, then we understand how important it is to choose people to represent us, to hire people to exercise our sovereign power in our name, that do so understanding the rule of law, understanding the Constitution, and its importance to, that they adhere to their oath to support the Constitution of the United States, and in most cases of their state as well. We hire better representatives, then we will have better government. As James Garfield said, now more than ever, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. If it be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, is because they tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. If it be intelligent, brave, and pure, it's because the people demand these fine qualities for those who represent them in the national legislature. Well, if that's true for Congress, Well, that's also true for your state legislature, and your governor, and your county boards, and your sheriff. Ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, it's up to us, which is why I'm out here in Grand Forks, North Dakota today, doing my Knowing Your Rights tour, helping people, everyday Americans, understand they too can read and study the Constitution. They can know what their rights are, and they can learn to defend and assert them. And most importantly, that we need to teach the rising generation to be free, because the government-run schools aren't doing it. So if you want to find out more about the tour, go to constitutionstudy.com/tour. I still have some dates in August, and I have people asking for additional dates and venues. If you are interested, go to the bottom of that page, fill out that form, and I'll see if we can get an event going in your location. And hey, if you can help donate to the cause, help me keep this going, I'd appreciate that greatly. But one thing I know about being on the road is it really is taxing on the body. It's really easy to get run down, to get your immune system to give up, and to get sick. You know, and I'm going to be on the road 10 straight days. I'm doing 6 cities in 6 days straight with 2 days of travel on either side. So it's a busy time. So I'm using Healthy Cells Immune Super Boost. And you can find out more by going to healthycell.com/outloud. You'll get 20% off your first order. You can try any of their products. Again, I'm using the Immune Super Boost to help keep me healthy and going so I can keep doing these events and I can keep bringing these programs to you. And you can try it now for 20% off. Again, just go to healthycell.com/outloud to get 20% off your first order.
Each of us is born with 30 trillion cells that make us. These cells determine how we feel, perform, sleep, focus, and how long we live. And to live our best life, all we have to do is feed our cells. But most food and supplements don't reach our cells, keeping us from reaching our full potential. Make every cell count with Healthy Cell. Founded with a mission to empower people to take control of their own health at the most fundamental level, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, world-renowned cell researcher and medical doctor, created supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. And that's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL. And use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome back to the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. And if I sound a little different today, if you're joining me late, I'm actually recording in a hotel room in beautiful Grand Forks, North Dakota. I'm on my Knowing Your Rights tour. I'm out and about. And if you hear something in the background or sound a little different, I do apologize. But I wanted to bring you this program, and I wanted to talk to you about our subject for today, which is judges, especially activist judges. You know, we talk about the First Amendment and the protections. One of the protections that I think often gets forgotten is the right to petition your government for a redress of grievance. And we have to remember that courts are part of government. So when we're talking about going to court, we talk about suing somebody charging someone with a crime, you are petitioning the government for a redress of some grievance. You feel you've been harmed some way and you want redress, you want recompense. Maybe you want a financial reward. Maybe you want the court to say, no, this person must fulfill this contract, or they cannot do what they've been doing. This is one of the fundamental freedoms of Americans. This idea that I have the right to go to government to petition them to find a redress to some wrong that I feel I've been done. Now, I'm not going to get into the First Amendment issue and, you know, Congress shall make no law and all that. But it's important to understand that because of this, because we tend to go to judges first for a redress of our grievance, it's important that they be held to a certain account. You know, we don't elect federal judges because we want them to be separate from a political process. We want them to be, we would hope they would be above the political fray. Sadly, that doesn't appear to be the case. And sadly, even in our rhetoric, we understand that, you know, how often have you heard to a judge referred to as an Obama judge or a Trump judge or a Reagan judge or a Republican appointed judge or a Democrat appointed judge? Because you understand they're human, which is why they're given judgment but not power. Now, this may be a new concept to a lot of you, so let me go back to Federalist Papers number 78. And in this, written by Alexander Hamilton, he says, "Whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary, far from the nature of its functions, will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution, because it will be the least in a capacity to annoy or injure them. The executive branch not only dispenses the honors, but holds the sword of the community. The legislature not only commands the purse, but prescribes the rules by which the duties and rights of every citizen are to be regulated. The judiciary, on the contrary, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of the society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm even for the efficacy of its judgments." See, when our founding fathers set up the Constitution, they set up the federal government, they recognized that power corrupts, so they had to split the powers up. They put the power of the purse, the legislative power, in the hands of the legislature. They put the executive powers, the sword, as Hamilton refers to it, in the hands of the president. And then they created this judiciary. And they recognized that should the judiciary have the ability to enforce its own actions, it would be dangerous. So they gave them no real power. The court does not have the ability to force you to do anything. They issue an opinion. And again, I'm talking federal courts. I'm not getting into state courts at the moment. So we'll talk about federal courts. They issue an opinion. No, they do not issue a ruling. If you read the document, it says in the opinion of the court. So they issue an opinion, and they expect the executive branch to actually take action if you do not comply. And this is for a very good reason. See, if the ability to judge includes the ability to execute, then you've kind of, not only have you broken down the separation of powers, you've put a tremendous amount of power in the hand of one branch of government, which kind of brings you back to what's going on with Biden and the CDC eviction moratorium. Because while the eviction moratorium is unconstitutional, and I'm going to keep repeating that because I don't want someone to get the wrong idea, the fact that the court has no mechanism to force the executive to do something, no legally binding mechanism, is actually a good thing. Now, the fact that we have a president that ignores the Constitution and is looking at this court and saying, and again, the court is, well, the court's made up of people. The court's fallible. Do we really want one body to have the ultimate power? If the executive cannot defy the courts, well, then we're no longer a republic, we're an oligarchy. We have 9 high priests in black robes that get to tell us what is and is not. And there is no check on them. So what President Biden is doing is a check on the courts. Now, I think it's a check for the wrong purpose. He's basically saying, I can still infringe on the rights of the people. I can violate the Constitution. I can violate my oath of office. Now, whether that's because what the court said was not that the CDC's eviction moratorium was unconstitutional, but that it was a power of Congress, not of the CDC, maybe that's why. I mean, he's looking at saying, well, listen, we can just go ahead and do this anyway. I don't know. But I'm getting, you know, back to this, a proper understanding of the Constitution is important if we are to remain free. We have to be able to enforce the Constitution for ourselves. The Constitution is ink on parchment. It's not going to get up and dope slap somebody because they're doing something wrong. It's not going to get up and dope slap President Biden because, he's violating the Constitution. You know, the Secret Service isn't going to have to tackle the Constitution to keep it from continually dope slapping these politicians, because that to me would be a full-time job with overtime. It's up to us to say, wait a second, this is not right. This is a violation of the Constitution, and that is, I mean, something to be taken seriously. So it's really up to us to educate ourselves and then educate our states, our state representatives, and say, hey, wait a second, do you realize that this eviction moratorium violates the Fifth Amendment? I mean, everybody's been talking about suing this. How many of you have gone to your state legislatures and said, here's the Fifth Amendment. You're telling me that the federal government has the authority to deprive landlords of their ability to remove renters who do not pay, of control of their property, and to do so without due process. And of course, somebody's going to come back, well, you know, there was this law, it's like time. Due process is defined by the Free Legal Dictionary as a judicial or governmental process that protects the rights of the individual. The CDC eviction moratorium does not protect the rights of the individual because you're depriving them of their property, not because of something they've done, but because of a mistake that the states have made and the federal government has made. So you have the states violating their own constitution and the Constitution of the United States. You have the federal government violating the Constitution of the United States, and now you're expecting the landlords to pay for it. It's the same with this $300 unemployment bonus. The states have caused this problem. The federal government is complicit. They violated their oaths. They violated their constitutions. But now you're expecting the American people to pay for that mistake. And when the states look at this and saying the medicine of this supplement is more damaging than the disease of the unemployment, you now have judges coming in and saying, well, that's too bad. You have to use this money. You have to bow to the federal government and do what they say and wait for the federal government to say, okay, now you can stop spending this money. Now you can stop taking this $300 a week. That's not a union. That's not 50 free and independent states that have joined together. That's a tyranny. That's a federal government that rules over everyone. That's not the federal government that's created by the Constitution that was created by the states. That's a federal government assuming it has authority over the states. Now, you're aware that there is a supremacy clause in the Constitution, and it reads, this Constitution and the laws of the United States made pursuant thereto, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the power of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And there's the catch. It is not all laws of the United States. It's all laws of the United States made pursuant to the Constitution. So any law that Congress passed that said we can enact a power that's not delegated to us in the Constitution is a violation of the 10th Amendment. Therefore, it's not pursuant to the Constitution. Therefore, it is not the supreme law of the land. Therefore, states are not bound to it, because both Alexander Hamilton and the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison said an act of Congress contrary to the Constitution is void. It's empty. It's meaningless. And until the states start realizing that they are not subjects of the federal government, they are its master, well, then they will continue to be bullied and bribed and forced around. But courts are important. Again, they offer judgment. Their job is to look at a controversy, look at the law, and come to a judgment as to what is the proper action. And I found this American Family News article talking about a Michigan farmer. And as I understand what happened, this farmer stated their opinion on Facebook. They believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. And for this reason, the city of East Lansing decided that this farmer would no longer be allowed to sell his goods at the city's farmer's market. So the city has a farmer's market, and they denied him the ability to rent a booth there to sell his wares. So here you have a man who has a grievance against the city of Lansing. And he goes to court to get an opinion that says, can the city of Lansing deny me access because of a religious belief I expressed on Facebook? Specifically, can they write an ordinance that will deny this farmer access to the farmer's market because of his religious beliefs? Now, I know most people will claim this is a First Amendment issue. As I've said over and over again, the First Amendment reads, Congress shall make no law. Therefore, this is not an act of Congress. Since it's not an act of Congress, it cannot be a violation of the First Amendment. What it is a violation of the Michigan Constitution. So where does he go to get redress? He goes to the courts. He's petitioning the government for redress of grievance. And I'm kind of curious where this goes, because like so many court cases that I review, you have a misunderstanding of the U.S. Constitution that's leading to a potential problem in the opinion. But this is the purpose of a court. It's to go and supposedly to get an objective opinion on a specific controversy. That's why, you know, outside of all courthouses, you see the statue of the Goddess of Justice. She's blindfolded. She's not partisan one side or the other. She's got balance scales. She's seeking justice. And that's really what these courts should be doing. The role of a judge is not to impose an idea. It's not to to seek redress for a past wrong or for some perceived injury. It's to look at the facts of the case in front of them, look at the law in the case in front of them, and then come to an opinion that would then guide the other branches of government. If it's a question of, okay, in our opinion, no, the city of East Kalamazoo cannot deny someone access to the farmer's market. They have no force, but this is their opinion. This is the proper role of courts, is that it is one of our places to seek a redress for our grievance. Now, what happens when the grievance comes in the other direction? There's a mother in Rhode Island who has been asking and attempting to get information about what her daughter will be taught when she enters kindergarten. She has requested this from the principal of the school. She says she's been stonewalled. They've been reluctant to provide this information. She then sought assistance or is receiving assistance from the Goldwater Institute, I believe it's a not-for-profit law firm. And in the midst of this proceeding, first the school sent her a bill for $74,000 to fulfill a records request. Now, I'm trying to understand, if you're a parent and you're asking, what is the curriculum that will be taught to my daughter next year? You want to see what that curriculum is. How does it cost $74,000 to come up with that information? Shouldn't you kind of have that on file already? Shouldn't it just be maybe at most $7.40 worth of copy paper? But she got this. But what this, you, she's now fighting with the school district to find out what her daughter will be taught. But this is where things get a little interesting. She's being sued by the Rhode Island National Education Association. That's right. She's being sued by the teachers' union. And I'm reading from the Goldwater Institute. They have a copy of the complaint. It says, this is an action for declaratory judgment and other relief concerning the appropriate treatment of various records requests pursuant to the Access to Public Records Act. In short, this action seeks to A, prohibit the disclosure of non-public records, and or B, for those requests that call for personally identifiable and other personal related information about the public school teachers, that no public records be disclosed until the court employs a balancing test that properly assesses the public interest in the records at issue against the measures of teachers' individual privacy rights. Okay. This is a duct tape moment, but I'm trying to figure out how curriculum information is suddenly non-public and personal. If you're a teacher in a public school, if you're a teacher anywhere, don't the parents have a right to know what curriculum you'll be using? Isn't that approved by the school board? Isn't that public information? Why is it being hidden? And how does that suddenly include personal identifiable information about the teacher? Unless to my knowledge, she's not asking for the teacher's name. Now, maybe she is. Maybe she's asked for the teacher's name and social security number and date of birth. I don't know. I don't think so. I think she's asking for the curriculum. But you see, this mother doesn't stop. Now you have the teachers' union, I'm assuming on behalf of a teacher, petitioning the government to say, please get this lady to leave us alone, to stop asking us for this information. But isn't this information that should be readily available? Now, again, I never sent my daughter, our daughter never went to public school. My wife and I had determined since we were married, two things. One, that one of us would be home with whatever child we had, whatever children we had, one of us would be home with them. And two, we would get them the best education possible. And that pretty quickly turned out to be homeschooling. Yes, I know it's a lot of work. My wife did a lot of work when my daughter was very young for that homeschooling. But this is part of the reason why. This idea that parents don't have a right to know what their children will be taught. That this was not as big a deal when my daughter was in school or was of school age. But it was not uncommon. I dealt with stuff like this. It's got to be 15 years ago now. 15 years ago, I met with a mother who was visibly upset because her daughter was taught her daughter was only 6-8 years old, was given a sexually explicit information in class. And when she went to the principal and asked why she was not given the opportunity to opt out, the principal said, well, because we find out if we allow people to opt out, they tend to do so. This idea that the government knows what's best for your children and the parents just get in the way. So this is a very interesting situation when you've got a teachers union suing. Now, it just says they're suing. It's not, they don't identify a teacher they're suing with. They just say we are, the union itself is suing this mother who is asking for what her daughter will be taught in school. In a quote-unquote public school. I say quote-unquote because theoretically, this is open to the public. Everybody can attend, but apparently not everybody's allowed to know what's going on in there. So this is another one of those cases that I'm following because it's, again, a petition for redress of grievance, but it's kind of the opposite of what we'd normally expect. You know, this isn't a union suing an employer for some malpractice. This is This is a union suing an individual for requesting data. Data that, from all the, what I've seen, is should be public information. This should not be, this again, unless she was asking for personal information about the teacher. I don't know, maybe what the teacher's name is the only thing I could think of she might ask, but that's, I'm trying to figure out what this is, what's behind what the NEA is doing. Because as I read through the complaint that the NEA has filed, they talk about the relationship with the school, and then they go, they talk about how in April of 2021, the defendant sent an email to the principal of Kingstown School with a list of questions and a request for records designed to gather information about, among other things, whether the school teaches critical race theory or otherwise includes it or other related concepts in its curriculum. Okay, sounds fair to me. The principal told the plaintiff, the defendant, I guess, that she should file a public records request. I don't know about you, but that would have given me pause. Why do I need to file a public request for curriculum information? It seems kind of a hoops to jump through. But she noted that in the complaint, she says by June 2nd, 2021, she has filed about 200 different records requests. Now, I'm not sure why. Is, you know, first of all, if it's still June, if this started in April and it's June and she's still waiting to get an answer, I'm kind of curious what's going on. Now, the complaint goes on to say that at one point the school committee considered whether it should file a lawsuit. And I've talked about that in the past. That was in my notes a while back. But apparently, in all of this hubbub, in all of this request for data that apparently is not being fulfilled, the request started asking for information about the union and their involvement and their reluctance to provide curriculum information. And this is going to be an interesting one to follow. This is, goes on to say, it really gets down to the question of what rights do the parents have in knowing what their children are being taught? What responsibilities do public schools have in reporting what is being taught in those schools? And what influence teachers' union have in the education of our children? Now, teachers' unions representing teachers is one thing. Teachers' unions controlling the curriculum, I'm not so sure about that. So that's, you know, that is, this again, this is a case that I need to keep an eye on, and I'll probably be talking about it later as it works its way through the courts. But as I think about all of these cases that I've talked about today, it got me thinking about the importance of understanding the proper role of our judicial branch and comparing that to the way the judicial branch gets treated today. The very idea that we believe that the judicial branch rules and that anybody that defies the judicial branch is an anarchist or unconstitutional or should be vilified. The idea of petitioning the government for redress of a grievance through the courts, and when is it appropriate and when is it used to intimidate? Is that a possibility as we're looking at some of these cases? Is the courts the proper venue to seek redress for a particular grievance? I think we all have grievances, and I think we've become a very litigious society. We seem to sue for everything, and we usually try to sue the entity that has the deepest pockets in the biggest court we can find. And I think that by doing so, we've lost some understanding of the right to petition. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have courts. I'm not saying we shouldn't petition through the courts. But understanding that what a federal court issues is an opinion, anything more than that is not within their scope. Now, they may issue injunctions and say, listen, we want you to not do this while we're going through this case, or we want you to continue to do this while we're going through this case. Those orders really should be meant to seek justice, to seek to minimize damage until the court has a chance to issue its opinion. But a court's opinion is just that, a court's opinion. And it is not the only place to seek redress of grievance. Federal courts are not the only place either. Sometimes you're looking at state courts because it's a state issue, but it's understanding that governments are instituted among men, as the Declaration of Independence says, to protect our rights. And they exercise only their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that sometimes that means we have to understand the scope of what government can do and what government should do. And then we need to decide what we will do. See, governments are our creations. The courts are our creations. The constitutions that embody them are our creations. And I think we've lost track of that, somehow we think our only redress is to go running to a court somewhere. So hopefully, you know, you'll think about maybe some court cases a little differently now. Hey, you want to find out more, head over to constitutionstudy.com. I'm spending a lot of time reviewing court opinions right now because the Supreme Court did their annual opinion dump. And of course, you can head to constitutionstudy.com/tour to find out more about this Knowing Your Rights tour. Help support us. Maybe invite me to come to speak at a location near you. It is by knowing our rights that we will remain free citizens of a republic rather than subjects to a tyrannical government. Now, I also want to remind you that all of my shows go to podcast typically a day or two after you hear them broadcast on talk radio. You can hear them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeart, basically anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And do me a favor, go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, leave me a rating, and then join me here next time for the Constitution Study.
Stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends every day.